This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the Reverend Jim Sessions, who's the president of the Working America Education Fund and a board member of the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice. And for generations, he's been doing good progressive work, largely in the South and Appalachia, for workers and interfaith coalitions. So he's got a lot to tell us. Jim Sessions, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
How'd you get into progressive politics? Tell me a little about your background.
Oh, well, I was born in Texas, and in those days, it was good to be a Democrat in Texas. And so I grew up with a family that revered John L. Lewis and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and just grew up in a family that was pretty good.
They were labor people.
No, I'm a preacher's kid. And so I grew up living in every little town between Waco and Abilene, the dad that moved around a lot being a preacher.
And you became a preacher yourself. Why did you do
that? Well, eldest son, so it was fated. It had to be. But I decided that I wanted to be in the ministry in a way that was different from my dad's. And so I kind of kept my bishops at arm's length and been able to take jobs and do work that made sense to me.
And have you ever gotten in trouble with a hierarchy?
Yeah. It's always funny. I was arrested one time in East Tennessee, but my bishop is in Boston. But I knew I had to go in and see the local bishop right away because it was in the papers and everything, and I was named as United Methodist minister. I'm sure he was going to get a call about that. So I walk into his office first thing the next morning when I was released. And I walk in, he says, they've already called me, and I've already told them, you're not mine, you belong somewhere else.
What were you arrested for?
I think that we were at the time sitting in Congressman Duncan's office trying to get him to vote against contrafunding.
So yeah. This was the 80s.
Yeah.
Reagan was president, and he was financing this illegal war in right. Central America.
Right.
And were you convicted or anything?
No.
Then you might have heard from him again.
Right.
You were living in Tennessee at that time. Is that when you were working with the Highlander Center?
At that time, I was with the Commission on Religion in Appalachia, which was an organization that was founded in 65, sort of as the religious part of the war on poverty in Appalachia, and as a way for religious organizations, denominations, to pool their monies so that there was a poverty fund from the religious community for grassroots organizations throughout Appalachia. So we did lots of co-op work and job retraining work, but also worked against strip mining and the Black Lung Movement and eventually with Miners for Democracy and a lot of other coal field issues that were going on. It was a great way for religious institutions to get involved with grassroots, real progressive work on the ground in Appalachia.
And you spent 3 decades doing work in Appalachia.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that region?
This could be a really long story, but I was a chaplain in New England, and I'd fallen in love with a young woman from Georgia, and I'm from Texas. And so we were thinking, now, where do we really want to spend our lives? We were not Catholic, and we were not African American, so we didn't really fit in terms of Protestant Black churches or Catholic white churches. We were white Protestants from the South. Where do they live and work? Appalachia is a place where that happens. And so East Tennessee was this wonderful nexus of a lot of things that were going on at that time in the late 60s and early 70s. Strip mining battles were taking place. Save Our Cumberland Mountains was just being organized. The Highlander Center was there. The Black Lung Movement was underway. The Council of Southern Mountains was alive and well and doing good work. So it was a very, very terrific, it was a lively place and a politically pertinent place for us to dig in.
I'm speaking with Jim Sessions, president of the Working America Education Fund and board member of the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice. You mentioned the Highlander Center. I'd mention it, too. Tell me briefly about your time there. I mean, the Highlander Center, a lot of people don't know, was a place where Rosa Parks went and Martin Luther King Jr. went.
It began as the Highlander Folk School in 1932. Three young seminarians just graduated from Emory, at Candler School of Theology at Emory University, and from Vanderbilt Divinity School, and from Union Seminary, Jim Dombrowski, Miles Horton, and Don West. And the three of them founded the Highlander Folk School as a kind of a school for working class people in southern Appalachia. They founded Mod Eagle, which is a place near Chattanooga, just on the where Alabama and Georgia and Tennessee come together. And they begin working with local working people, initially woodcutters, and then miners at the Wilder, at the famous Wilder strike in Wilder, Tennessee. Because of those experiences and their growing reputation, the CIO kind of tapped them to be their Southern labor training school. So they became the labor school in the South in the 30s and 40s. Well, and just to go further with that, they held the first integrated labor school in the South with the United Auto Workers in the early 1940s. Later on, they had integration workshops, and it's true that Rosa Parks came to one of those early integration schools months before she sat down on the bus in Montgomery.
That's the myth of Rosa Parks, you know, the myth of this woman all of a sudden just gets tired of going to the back of the bus.
She knew what she was doing. Another story, I think, from Highlander that is interesting to folks is that the song We Shall Overcome was heard and discovered by Miles Horton's wife, Zilphia Horton, at a tobacco workers' strike in Charleston. And she heard the strikers on the picket line singing We Will Overcome. And she loved the song and took it back to Highlander and taught it to Pete Seeger. And then some years later, Pete taught it to Guy Carawan, and they changed the words a little bit. And about that time, Guy was invited by the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, to their first organizing conference in North Carolina to be their song leader, and he taught them that song that night.
You know, there's a new book out on that song itself by Stuart Stotts, who's here in Madison. I'm going to have in the studio in a couple of weeks, so I'm looking forward to. He's a guitar player too and a singer-songwriter, so I'm looking forward to reading the book and having him explore that in a little more detail.
That is great. Pete and others, including the tobacco workers, copyrighted the song and formed the We Shall Overcome Fund. So anytime that song is performed commercially, income flows into the We Shall Overcome Fund, and that fund is totally dedicated to the promotion of minority cultural events in the South.
Well, that was a smart move, certainly. Jim Sessions, how long were you at the Highlander Center?
I was on the board for about 15 years, and then I was the director for 5.
Okay. And tell me, you're now at the Working America Education Fund. What is that?
The Working for America Education Fund is really sort of the a governance body for Working America. And Working America is a membership organization throughout the country so that people can become kind of fellow union members with other international unions through the FLCI and through the Working America.
And so it is. It's an affiliate, essentially, of the FL.
It's an affiliate of the FLCIO, yeah. Okay. It's kind of the community union affiliate.
Because I know there's this big push by the AFL, and I guess this is the embodiment of that push, to get people involved in the labor movement who can't form or become a labor union member in their shop, or
right.
If they're just in the community and are in a workplace to join a union,
right.
They can involve themselves.
Right. But it's a membership that's a really great turnout membership, because they hit the streets when they need to, when they have priorities that they develop.
What are the biggest problems facing working people today?
I only speak from where I live, and I would say in East Tennessee and southern Appalachia, it's poverty, and especially rural poverty. And obviously jobs have been lost, and there are layoffs constantly and steel plant closings going on. And we hear about that mainly from cities like Chattanooga and Asheville and Nashville and Knoxville, but in truth, what people don't hear is the incredible poverty that's happening in the rural South. This winter has been an incredibly cruel winter for rural people. And so there's been migrations from people leaving their homes and leaving their farms, leaving their homesteads in the rural parts of the mountains because they just can't survive there and live. And so we have a lot of people moving into the cities, and we are all ready for this winter to be over.
And do they come to you and you hear their stories, or how do you hear about
them? We do hear their stories, but mainly we hear about them because they are needing housing, they're needing food, they're looking for jobs, but there are no jobs. It's a tough scene.
I'm talking with Reverend Jim Sessions, who was board member of the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, president of the Working for America Education Fund. He's been doing good work in Appalachia for 3 decades now or more. I saw a statistic the other day that puts this recession in sharpest relief, and that is that the lowest 10% on the income scale of Americans, the unemployment rate is 30%.
Oh, sure.
And for the next 10%, the unemployment rate's about 20%. And so we look at the unemployment figure at 10% or 9.7% nationally. We don't realize that it's just crushing a whole segment of our people in this country, the people who are least able to survive it because
they're
the poorest people.
Well, I think it's a general rule of thumb that the real unemployment's always double what the Labor Department reports. And that's especially true in minority communities and in rural communities where the count doesn't even take place.
And the supports for unemployed people are not what they used to be, or not what they should be anyway. And so I'm faulting Barack Obama, and I wondered what your reaction is to the president after more than a year now in, that he hasn't done more, that he talked about the fierce urgency of now during the presidential campaign, and he talked about jobs as a top priority, but I know he passed that first stimulus, but it just wasn't big enough, and it's not urgent enough right now.
Well, it's a really hard question because I'm so torn about it. I and everyone I know worked really hard for him, and especially we bailed out of Tennessee and worked hard in North Carolina and Virginia and Indiana. That's mainly where Tennesseans went.
And had success in all three places?
Success in all three places. My wife and I worked in Charlotte for a week and a half, and stayed there until the polls closed, and Charlotte went for Obama 2-1 in the largest city in North Carolina. So, a lot of hope invested there. But my hope is still there.
And, tell me about that because the people I talk to have less hope than
I understand. I understand. But I think it's too quick a call to make. He was handed a bankrupt country, a bankrupt economy before he even walked into the Oval Office, plus two wars. And everything else. I mean, it's almost like the last administration really booby-trapped everything they could find when he walked into that office. And so we have to give him that a little bit. Plus, the total 100% knee-jerk, lock, elbow-to-elbow obstructionism of the other party is just unprecedented. But I grew up with Lyndon Johnson moving and shaking and making things happen in the Senate, and he and Everett Dirksen and Howard Baker and everybody, they figured out how to work things out. It's not true in this Senate, in this Congress, and I just don't think you fault Obama for that because he has worked and hard to do that. But you have this total obstructionist party to have to share that city with, and I think that's tough. It's also this morning I was just remembering Obama was a community organizer. He wasn't a labor organizer. And those are really two different ways of going about things.
What's the difference?
Well, if you're a labor organizer, you know that you have to get 50% plus one to win anything. In a community organization, you can show up in a large city with several hundred people and make a big impression on office holders and come away with a good vote from city council. So I just think that I think he's learning. And that's what I tried to say this morning. I think there are things he didn't know, as anyone would not know when they go into that office. And I think one thing that's true, if you read of his life and know about Obama, that he's a learner. And I think he's learning. And this has been a year of learning really tough lessons that were left behind by the last administration and an obstructionist party he has to deal with. And I think he's learning, and we're going to see some payoff from that learning.
Well, Jim Sessions, what is it that you think he's learning? Is he learning that this tilting after bipartisanship isn't going to work?
I think that's clear. And I think he learned that earlier than we know. But I think he's having to play things out in a way of hurting these cats towards the goal line. And I just still have this, possibly naive, but still I have this hope I guess was catching when he was running, he's going to pull some things off that has yet to happen.
Well, I know my wife knocked on doors, and my daughter did too, and one of my sons did as well. And so my wife tells me not to be a hater. I'm not a hater, but I'm disappointed, and I'm pretty skeptical, and I thought the chances of him being an FDR type of a figure were pretty low.
Well, FDR did not have an easy time his first year either. And some of his major achievements didn't happen until after the first year was into the second and third year. So it's not the model, I think. I mean, I think Obama will come through. But, I mean, I'm disappointed too. Who couldn't be disappointed about the health care bill? And who can be disappointed about EFCA not coming, the Employee Free Choice Act?
Well, tell me about the Employee Free Choice Act, and is there an ember left?
I do not have an insider news about that at all. I think it must happen, and I think it will, but I don't know when it's going to be.
How do you respond to the criticism, mostly from the right, but also from people like George McGovern, who said, you know, by doing away with the secret ballot, this is a bad thing. This is the check off to join a union. The Employee Free Choice Act would let people do that.
Well, I think it's not an informed comment. Mm-hmm. Workers have an option of how they want to either cast their ballot or have card check. The whole point of EFCA is for the procedure for determining an election to be in the hands of the employees and the workers and not in the hands of the employers. As it stands now, the employer has that decision. And so forth. This way, there's a choice as to whether they have a secret ballot or not.
And the employer, not a lot of people recognize the upper hand that the employer has had all along here, almost since the Taft-Hartley Act, where, and right now, they're flagrantly violating the law. 25% of, of elections, the employer is cited for unfair labor practices, and they're not penalized, though, or the penalty is just the weakest slap on the wrist.
Well, for 8 years, there's been no enforcement of the law through the Labor Department, and we've had a National Labor Relations Board that basically worked for the corporations.
Right.
So there's really been no labor law. There's been no labor law enforcement. There's been no agency or accountability by corporations. So it's been rampant that way. And I think it's time that the playing field gets at least balanced in this way. We have a wonderful election in East Tennessee where poultry workers, all Spanish-speaking poultry workers, finally had an election that they initiated themselves. The Highlander Center provided the bilingual translation that made a lot of that organizing possible. Those employees voted in a poultry plant in one of the most anti-union small towns in all of East Tennessee, 485-17.
Wow.
To be represented by United Food and Commercial Workers. We helped them participate in the negotiations for a contract. They got a first contract to vote on, and they voted it down unanimously. Solidarity, and then they had to go back to the bargaining table and improve the contract and match their grievances about it, and they came back and offered them a second contract, which they accepted unanimously. So hope springs eternal, and I think we hope for the best.
I'm speaking with the Reverend Jim Sessions, who's a board member of the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, president of the Working America Education Fund. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. What is the importance of interfaith coalitions on these worker rights issues, labor organizing issues?
Well, it's in a little story I just told. The Interfaith Worker Justice group in East Tennessee, for instance, went to the poultry company and said, who had hired a labor union-busting lawyer, said, we want a fair election over here. The workers, it's by law, deserve that, and we'll get it. If you do not behave, if you try to intimidate in this election, we will be at your plant gates with little candles holding our clergy vigil until you allow a decent election. The company wanted to be a good citizen in this community, did not want a bad reputation, aspires to being Purdue or Tyson, and wants a good reputation. And so under that kind of persuasion by local clergy, they fired their lawyer. The workers got a straight election that was honest, and they won it. I just think that community pressure, community influence, the insistence by clergy rightly that there should be decency and balance and equity in these campaigns can make a difference in organizing, and we've seen it happen.
Reverend Jim Sessions telling us a positive story out of East Tennessee with poultry workers organizing successfully a union and a first contract. Let's move on to a subject that is getting a lot of ink these days, and that's the Tea Party movement. There are some liberals, Democrats, progressives who totally write the movement off, think they're a bunch of yahoos. Even the expression Yahoo is a tricky one.
We say Yahoo.
What is your observation about the Tea Party movement?
Well, I'm just one more citizen that is observing this phenomenon, though I've gone to two Tea Parties.
Really?
And,
where were they?
In Knoxville and another small town near Knoxville in East Tennessee. And then the Tea Partiers had a conference, this national conference in Nashville. Just a week or so ago, where Sarah Palin spoke for a $100,000 fee. And just to be admitted to the conference, you had to have $600 spare change in your pocket. So anyway, just to say, my observation, just a personal observation, is that there are Tea Partiers and there are Tea Partiers. And they come from lots of different grievances for lots of different reasons. It's a real mishmash of unhappiness. I think underlying a lot of the unhappiness, apart from kind of specific issues, ideological, libertarian, religious, and other issues that exist within those gatherings, underlying a lot of that is economic unhappiness. And I think there are legitimate, real economic justice grievances that many of these people share. And in many ways, I think they're our people. And some of the same reasons for wanting change in Washington and wanting economic change for themselves and for their communities and for their families that they voted for Barack Obama, some of them, in the first place, they're now going back out again saying, listen, this is not happening. What we look forward to isn't happening. The hope we had is not happening. The change we want is not happening. The bankers are richer and richer. The financial people who put us into this jam are making off like bandits, and here we've been left once again, and they're not happy. And I think a lot of this, what I observe is there's an economic justice base to what a lot of the Tea Partiers are doing. And I think that both the unions and the Democratic Party would do well to be listening to some of these people and to finding ways to know how to respond to these hopes and dreams that they still have.
Well, that was going to be my next question. If there are people, or if some of them are our people, how do we reach them?
Well, we have to let them reach us first, I think. I was asked that question this morning. How do we get them to listen to our message? Well, I think, first of all, we have to find out what their message is and be able to respond to that. So I think we are not listening to them. We're characterizing them and stigmatizing them and stereotyping them, and we have to kind of put that aside, sort out who the yahoos are in this group and who are the real economic justice grievances that they have, and to listen to what those are and be able to respond to them. I think that the administration has ways to do this, but whether they're hearing and listening closely enough and respecting, I think, where this is coming from, I'm not sure. I don't know that yet. But it can happen. And I think changes – I think this movement can behave in a very creative way in public policy if we pay attention.
The problem is, and you mentioned the stereotyping and the dismissiveness, is that some of the, and you said there are tea parties and there are tea parties, some of the tea parties are really far right, and some of them may be racist and anti-Semitic.
No question.
But on the other hand, I heard Mike Malloy on the syndicated radio show saying every single one of the tea parties, partiers is racist at bottom, and we should just ignore the whole crowd.
Well, that may be true, and I mean, the whole resistance by the Republican Party, I think this president is different, and they're treating him differently.
Because of race?
I think because of race. I think that may be unconscious. There is a racism that none of us, especially as a white guy who was raised in the South, I'm not free of that racism. And I think anyone who claims that they are needs to take a second thought.
Well, this is what Andy Young told us this in 1978.
So it's no surprise to say that there's racism across the board among the Tea Partiers. It would be no shock to me and not a surprise. But that's there. It's sometimes more overtly there and more dangerously there than others. But that it's there, I think, is probably true. It's also true there, I think, in the opposition, the privileged and polite opposition to Obama also has a similar base.
Do you worry about Obama being assassinated?
Sure. Every day.
Every day. What's your assessment of Sarah Palin?
Oh, I'm breathless to answer. I don't have really an answer to that. I don't see that she deserves a serious answer or analysis, really.
My worry is that, you know, she might, I mean, I can conceive of her winning the presidency. I can certainly conceive of her winning the Republican nomination because they're the most conservative elements of the party turn out in higher percentages. And then, depending on the economy, who knows in a head-to-head race?
I don't think so.
Tell me why not.
Well, I just think there are movers and shakers in the Republican Party that are smarter than that. And I do think that the American electorate is smarter than that.
Well,
I feel like my faith in democracy in this country was fulfilled some in this last presidential election. How that could turn around with a Sarah Palin in the next one is blows my mind.
So that would be a huge 180.
I can't believe that.
And if you and your wife were in Charlotte or in Indiana or in Virginia, you don't think you'd see all those Sarah Palin buttons and bumper stickers at least getting that 50+1, do
Listen,
you?
I have been wrong so many times.
Hey, you
so
and me
many
both.
Times. and so many times I've said, I'm never going to make a prediction again because I have been wrong so many times. But I just don't see it.
And so we only have about 30 seconds left. I'm just wondering, what do you recommend that people do, progressives do right now?
Well, one thing that we've already said is to listen to these folks and to find ways to respond as brothers and sisters to them and not as stigmatizers of them. I think some patience with our president. I think more impatience with our senators and our congressmen. I don't see him being patient with them any longer. But I think some more support for our president. We need to do that. And I'm going to stick with it.
Well, it's been great hearing your view and hearing some of your wisdom for all your years and years of work. Reverend Jim Sessions, thanks so much for being my guest on Progressive Radio.
It's been a treat.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.